Getting off her hair and skin, her bra and panties soaked, and her guise and mannerisms completely calm. The man lowered his hand. He was above her on the mezzanine, and he looked at her several more seconds before speaking down to her. In broken English, with a Russian accent, he said, "What are you doing here?" Zoya looked up at him, unashamed and proud. In Russian, she spoke with defiance. "What does it look like I'm doing?" She saw the flicker of understanding on the man's face.
"You are here with the boss?"
She walked over to a towel rack. With a half-sigh, she replied in Russian, "Of course he couldn't last 10 minutes, and I still had a lot of energy to burn." A smile crossed the man's lips, though he tried to hide it. Zoya toweled off while the man leered at her. He thought she was a prostitute, which had been her aim, and so far her plan was succeeding. The exit to the room was off the balcony, so she climbed the stairs barefoot, still drying her wet hair with the thick towel. As she passed the guard, she looked him up and down. With a little smile, she said,
"Next time, maybe, I will find some other way to exercise before bed."
The Russian bodyguard grinned.
"You're a little slut, aren't you?"
Zoya smiled till she walked through the door, and then her smile disappeared in an instant and she rolled her eyes. Seconds later, she roamed the halls, looking for her target's bedroom. She turned in the direction of where she thought she'd find her target, to her left down a long hall, and she started moving barefoot across the carpet. There were at least 2 more security men inside the house. She heard them talking and watching TV to her right towards the den as she turned left to ascend the stairs. She picked her way up a quiet staircase, turned left towards the master, and listened carefully for any noises. 1 minute later, Zoya stood in front of the bedroom door, hesitating a moment. She knew the man she was coming to speak to, or once did anyway. He'd never married, never had children, and somehow he had been so steadfast in this even long ago that she thought it unlikely this had changed in the intervening years. He should be alone right now at 1 a.m., but she had to allow for the possibility that he was not. She pulled out her folding knife and opened it before reaching for the door latch. Chapter 25. Zoya took 3 full minutes standing still so that her eyes could become accustomed to the darkness, and when they finally did, she began moving silently in her bare feet towards the 4-poster bed in the middle of the room. When she saw a single figure in the bed, she slowed down a little more, but continued forward. Standing over the lone form, she looked around. She slid open the drawer to the side table next to him, but found it empty other than a few pill bottles and a pair of reading glasses. She walked around to the other side of the bed. It was unmade, but empty, and she smelled the strong scent of a woman's perfume and the faint scent of sex. Looking away, she checked the nightstand there as well. She sighed silently in frustration. Finally, she reached under the pillow on the unmade side of the bed and pulled out a pistol. It was a Checkmate CZP-01, a compact aluminum-framed semi-auto, and Zoya immediately flipped off the safety and moved it out of the man's reach. This done, she climbed slowly into bed next to the form there and inched her way over. And this caused the man to stir. He reached a hand out, and it landed on her breast. He started to smile and squeeze, but when Zoya pressed the blade of the knife up against the man's fleshy throat, hard enough to cut him superficially, his hand let go and his eyes opened in surprise. He pulled his hand away and began sliding it under the pillow next to him. In Russian, Zoya said,
"You make any noise and you die. Then I shoot my way out of here with the gun you had hiding under your pillow."
The man tried to look at her, but it was clearly too dark for him to make out facial features.
"You are a woman.
And you are perceptive. I will kill you just the same if you try anything. Do you understand me?"
"Yes. Yes, of course. No noise, or you chop off my head. I've got it."
"Very good. Now, slowly. I want you to turn on your bedside lamp, Vladdy."
Upon hearing the diminutive of his name, Vladimir Belyakov reached out and grabbed the lamp pole. When the light flickered on, he blinked hard, as did Zoya, both struggling to becoming accustomed to the light. But after a second, he turned to the woman next to him in bed with her knife still pressed against his jowls. Belyakov was 65 years old, short and fat, with dyed black hair so thin across the top as to be useless, but still rather thick on the sides. Zoya hadn't seen him in over 10 years, and he'd certainly aged, but she'd expected he would have no problem recognizing her instantly. She was wrong. After several seconds staring at her, he said,
"I'm sorry, madam, but I am hopelessly farsighted. Can I put on my glasses?"
"They are on top of your nightstand. Your hand goes anywhere else, and I sink the blade up under your chin, through your tongue, and into the roof of your mouth. Then I twist."
He reached for his glasses slowly and put them on. While he did so, Zoya lay down closer to him, keeping the knife where it was, but positioning her body where they could both speak in whispers. The man stared at her for several seconds more.
"Is that... it can't be. Zoya?"
"Hello, Uncle Vladdy."
You're alive?"
"I think you have your answer. It's been quite a while, hasn't it?"
Belyakov seemed absolutely poleaxed.
I should say so. Moscow. 10 years ago, was it? Your graduation from SVR. One of the proudest days of my life. Even though I was only a friend of the family."
"But a close friend, Vladdy. You always were. You looked in on me when you were home and my father was away. There were entire years I spent more time with you than I did with Papa."
Belyakov nodded a little, but not too much, because the knife was still in place. Drops of blood had already made their way down his throat.
"It is wonderful to see you. You do know everyone. Everyone thinks you're dead," he said.
"Do I look dead?"
You look more beautiful than ever. But why are you in your underwear? Why are you all wet?"
She didn't answer. Instead, she said,
"I need to talk to you."
"My dear, we can talk without you sneaking in here, crawling into my bed and threatening me. Why on earth have you come to me in the night like this?"
"You are my father's best friend. You told me you were there that night in Dagestan when he died."
Belyakov blinked in genuine surprise, as if he'd had no idea why Dagestan would possibly come up.
"I was.
Killed by rebels, I think you told me."
"Indeed. Sharia Jamaat, they were called at the time. They are still around, but go by Vilaya Dagestan now. We kicked their asses back then. They still haven't recovered."
"A lucky mortar round did him in?"
"Why are you asking all this?" "Yes, of course. As I told you at the time."
He looked away again, shut his eyes for a moment.
"Please, Fio was my best friend, and your papa. Let's not dredge up such painful memories."
"They aren't that painful, Vladdy. Papa and I have something in common. Everyone thinks he's dead too, but he's not, is he?"
The short man squinted through his glasses, a dumbfounded look on his face.
"Sto?
What?
Don't be ridiculous, of course he is."
Zoya just stared him down.
"My darling, what is going on? Why would you think..."
"I've seen the pictures purporting to show his body. Classified photos from GRU, but he was alive when the photos were taken. They were staged."
"I was there, Zoya."
"I saw you in the photos, so I know you were there. And that means you are lying about what happened. And that is why I am here. Look,"
she interrupted him.
"Look at these."
She pulled down her sports bra to reveal the top of her breasts.
"They are faint, but they are there. They're called stress hives. I get them when I'm anxious. I always have gotten them, since I was a kid, right here."
This was a lot for Belyakov to process, she could see in his eyes. He stared at her upper chest, right into her cleavage. Zoya did seem to have several light but unmistakable pink splotches there. She continued,
"In my line of work, of course, anxiety is something I learned to manage. But I've never been able to fake out the hives. If it's a stressful enough situation, they will appear."
"But what does that have to do with..."
"My father had the exact same condition. Higher on his neck, on the side, but just as noticeable as on me. When he would have a bad day at work, my mother would say to my brother and me that if Papa had the red rash on his neck, we should leave him alone and wait for him to come to us."
Belyakov waved her statement away with his hand.
I was on the scene within moments after the mortar round hit. If you say I was in the photo, then you see. It had just happened. Perhaps the hives stay on the body after death. You haven't died before, so you don't know.
The rash disappears when the stress is relieved within seconds. Nothing relieves stress quite like death, Vladdy. He was alive in the photos, and anxious, which I can believe if he had to feign his own death in the middle of a combat zone. But, and the other body next to him, that man was dead. His blood had congealed, not much, but a little. He might have been dead 30 minutes, an hour at most, but I've seen a lot of bodies, Vladdy, and there is no way both men were killed by the same mortar round.
This is all fantasy, my darling. I understand why you want it to be true, but it simply is not true.
Zoya pressed the knife tighter against his throat, but this did not change his story.
Fjo is dead. Your papa is gone, darling. Kill me too, if you must, but that won't bring your dear father back to life.
Zoya leaned closer to the older man now, right in his ear.
I always liked you, but even as a little girl, I knew you were his bitch. Did whatever he told you to do. After he was declared dead, you left GRU and went into the oil business, made billions. That only happens with state approval. The Kremlin set you up here in London, and there must be a reason why they did that. I never put it together until I saw you in the picture and realized my father was alive. You are still connected to him somehow, still connected to the Kremlin, and London holds the key.
Crazy talk, asinine. We Russians leave Russia and come here when we have the means to do so, because the Kremlin wants to take our riches from us. This is the only place we can protect them from the greedy Siloviki who run the Rodina.
Zoya shook her head with certainty.
I've been following your career since you left military intelligence. No way you're working against the Kremlin. You were always a loyal servant, both to my father and to the Rodina. Nothing has changed except your bank account and your location. Now that I know my father is alive, I am wondering why you are here with so much money and what it is you are doing, she added. Are you still his bitch?
What am I doing? I am raising horses. I am donating to charity. I am buying property all over the world. I am fucking a different hooker every night, if you must know. What I am not doing is spending my money helping your dead father.
His voice had grown louder with each word, and Zoya slapped him hard against his face to shut him up. His glasses flew off onto the nightstand. Momentarily stunned, he reached for them and put them back on. When he turned back to the bed, the knife was gone from Zoya's hand, but the Czech pistol was there in its place.
You fire that gun, and my 12-man security team will be on you in an instant.
It's a 6-man security team, 8 perhaps, if 2 of them are somewhere sleeping, and the safety of London has made all of them slow, fat, and lazy. I, on the other hand, am still Russian, and I am fast, lean, and hungry for the truth.
Truth? What truth? A fantasy is what you're after.
Zoya reached over him to the table and to his mobile phone. Handing it to him, she said,
Open it.
He did so and handed it back to her. Zoya kept the gun on the man who had been like a second father to her, but she scrolled through his contacts, his text messages, and his phone calls. She looked first for her father's name, although she knew both he and Belyakov would have been too smart to use it. She checked a few of the many aliases he used, the diminutive of his name, but found nothing that looked relevant. She scrolled through text messages, some in English, some in Russian, and stopped at one from the day before. It was an exchange with a man named Terry Cassidy, and it was in English. I have some things I need to get out of your safe, Belyakov wrote. In Berlin at the moment, came the reply. Return tomorrow. Can this wait till Wednesday, or do you need to go to my office without me? It can wait. Lunch Wednesday? Belyakov replied. Excellent. You do your business with the safe, and then we'll walk over to the club. Zoya looked at Belyakov, wanted to ask him about Terry Cassidy and his safe where Belyakov held items, but knew better than to tip him off to her interest. She pulled up a random text message to hide what she'd been looking at, locked the phone, and threw it on the bed.
Fucking useless.
The Russian expatriate oligarch cocked his head.
Was that English, Zoya?
Shit,
Zoya realized she'd switched to English accidentally. She faked a smile.
As Papa always told me, own your cover.
Belyakov smiled a little too at this.
Why, Zoya? Why do you come with weapons to find your father? If you think he is alive, what threat does he pose to you?
She hesitated for several seconds and started to say something twice, but each time she stopped herself. When she finally did speak, she did not answer his question.
I will leave you now, Vladdy, but I can come back at any time. When I go, I want you to call him, tell him I was here, and tell him his daughter only wishes to see her papa. Will you do that for me?
Pleadingly, the old man said,
How can I do that, Zoya Fyodorovna? He is buried up in Mytishchinsky. You've been to his damn grave, girl.
The Federal Military Memorial Cemetery was in the Mytishchinsky district, on the outskirts of Moscow to the northeast.
Zoya said, You're right, I have been there. And I knelt down and wept over the grave of a man I never met, because whoever is buried in my father's plot at Mytishchinsky is not my father.
Belyakov sank his head back into the pillow.
Come back tomorrow, in the light. You and I can have breakfast together, and we can talk more.
Zoya did not answer. She just climbed off the bed, the pistol still level at the prostrate man's chest, and backed off into the dark. Seconds later, Belyakov heard the bedroom door shut softly. He started to reach for his alarm button to alert his security team, but he thought against it. Shooting Zoya Zakharova would cause vastly more troubles for him than it would solve. No, better she got out of here safe and sound. Belyakov did, however, reach for his mobile. He scrolled through his contacts and tapped the one for David Mars. Mars lived in Notting Hill, also here in London, and it took him several rings to answer the phone. With a hoarse and tired voice, Mars said,
Vladimir? What bloody time is it? Why are you calling me so damn late? We need to meet, very first thing in the morning. What is it? I can't... Not on the phone. Come here for breakfast, then. No, said Belyakov. The old place. The old place? How much vodka have you drunk tonight? The old place.
Mars hesitated, then said,
All right. 7 a.m.? Yes, that will work.
Belyakov hung up the phone and rubbed his eyes under his glasses. Chapter 26 St. James's Park was a major tourist attraction in central London, and right in the center of it was a bit of espionage history. The Tin and Stone Bridge had been used by British intelligence officers to meet local contacts for years, and the placid area with good sight lines meant it was also a common meeting place for others looking for quiet, candid conversations. At 7 a.m., there weren't many tourists out, but a few men and women walked through the park on their way to work. Russian billionaire oligarch Vladimir Belyakov arrived at the Tin and Stone Bridge first, holding his umbrella above him to keep his tailored business suit and raincoat dry. He sat on a green park bench, looked to his two security men who stood closer to the pond in front of him, and continued scanning in all directions. Light rain trickled from the hoods of their open raincoats. Belyakov himself scanned the area to make sure no one was around in eavesdropping distance, and then he spent the next moments thinking about what he was going to say. Well before he'd decided on a suitable script, he saw David Mars walking across the bridge. There were three men with him, including that British beast John Hines looming behind, and the younger man with the goatee and the Seville Row suit walking next to Mars. The third man, Belyakov assumed, was one of the security officers who accompanied Mars wherever he went. Vladimir Belyakov focused on the one called Fox. He had no idea of the man's real name, but was well aware that he was tied to Russian organized crime, and as erudite and dapper as he appeared, he no doubt dealt a lot of death and woe to those who got in his way. Mars's Israeli bodyguard, Fox, and Fox's British giant and bodyguard held back 20 yards or so, while Mars walked all the way up to the bench and sat down next to the short, balding 65-year-old. The men did not greet each other. Instead, they just looked out towards the narrow pond in front of them. Mars spoke first. He sounded annoyed, rushed, as if he had other places to be.
"This bench, this bridge, it's always bad news when we meet here. Usually I am the one needing something from you, but now, damn it, Vladdy, I've got a lot on my plate. What the hell couldn't be handled via our encrypted phones? They needed to be face-to-face with you for this."
Belyakov balanced his umbrella against his shoulder and turned to face Mars, which was hardly the protocol for a clandestine meet. Mars saw this in his peripheral vision.
"Vladdy, turn back around, damn you."
The Russian oligarch ignored him and kept looking his way.
"What I'm about to tell you will be difficult to hear, David. Someone broke into my house last night, held a knife to my throat, a gun to my head."
Still looking ahead, still annoyed about Belyakov's pivot to face him, Mars said,
"Someone? Who? Someone who knows the name Fyodor Zakharov."
Mars sat back on the bench slowly. He blew out a sigh.
"A woman?" he asked. "Duh. How did you know?"
Mars turned fully to Belyakov now, his own umbrella low and the rain dampening his dark hair and his coat. He was giving up on the tradecraft because his partner in this meet had already done so.
"I've been looking for a woman who knows. She was in America 2 nights ago. She either told the CIA or they told her. This must be her. What did she look like?" "David,"
Belyakov spoke through a dry throat.
"I am..."
Mars looked in the Russian's eyes now, any last vestige of protocol gone.
"You recognized her, didn't you? You know who she is." "I do, David. It was Zoya."
David Mars blinked once, hard, then grunted angrily.
"What the fuck were you and your hooker drinking last night, Vladdy? You know as well as I do that Zoya was killed by the Americans 4 months ago in Thailand."
Belyakov shook his head.
"Apparently the Thailand story was disinformation. She's not dead. Far from, I swear."
David Mars looked away, out through the rain to the swans in the pond swimming languidly. His eyes were unfixed, but quickly they began filling with tears. From 20 yards away, Fox stared at him, but Mars ignored the younger man. His voice broke a little as he spoke.
"Is there any way you could have been mistaken? Or that this was some sort of a trick by the Americans?"
Vladimir Belyakov pointed to a long, shallow cut on his thick neck.
"She was close enough to do this to me. She was in my face for 5, 10 minutes. Of course I know Zoya when I see her. Even after all these years."
Mars wiped tears away with his shirt sleeve.
Did she seem all right? Is she hurt?" "Same old Zoya. Somehow she broke into my Belgravia home that I spent millions to secure. She had to be a world-class operative, a gymnast even, to get through my security. I'd say she's as healthy as ever."
David Mars wiped away more tears now, and he smiled. After several seconds, he spoke hoarsely.
"My beautiful, beautiful little Zoyushka. She is alive."
Belyakov put a hand on Mars's shoulder and switched to Russian.
"Da,"
he spoke softly now.
"Da, Fyodor Ivanovich. Your precious daughter is alive and well."
The man who called himself David Mars for the last 14 years let his umbrella drop into the path, then put his face in his hands and wept openly. It was a full minute before he got hold of himself, and Belyakov just sat there the entire time, averting his eyes from his old friend's emotion and watching the ducks and swans. Fox, Hines, and Mars's bodyguard had taken up positions around the bench, but they all stole glances at the last scene they ever thought they'd set eyes on. David Mars broken down in tears. Finally, Mars wiped his eyes with a handkerchief, picked his umbrella back up and covered himself with it, although he was all but soaked now. He said,
"What? What was she doing there, with you? She wanted me to tell her about you."
"What about me?"
"She knows you're alive, Fjo."
"But how?"
"Somehow she saw the photos of you back in Dagestan. The ones used to prove your death on the battlefield. The ones we staged with you lying next to that poor bastard colonel who caught the mortar round. What was his name?"
Mars answered distractedly, as if this were not an important point to Belyakov's story.
"Sokolov, field artillery."
"Yes, right. She saw your pictures, and she said something about hives. What the fuck, David? You get welts on your neck when you're nervous? How did I never know this?"
David Mars brought his right hand up to his neck and rubbed the exact spot Zoya had indicated.
"She knew to look for them."
Belyakov waited for a response, but when none came, he said,
"Those files were sealed by GRU as soon as your death was announced. I don't know how she saw them, but she did."
David Mars, once known as Fyodor Zakharov, now understood without question that Zoya, his only daughter, was the woman in the CIA safe house he'd ordered raided two nights earlier. She was alive, which made his heart sore, but only until he connected the rest of the dots. She had to have been working for the Americans now. They'd made it look like she'd died in a raid on a yacht off the coast of Thailand. They brought her back to America. They'd brainwashed her and turned her, and now they were directing her back out, sending her to find her own father, whom they'd determined was alive and in play. Belyakov said,
"I know where she's going next."
"Where?"
"Terry Cassidy's office. Tonight would be my guess."
Now Mars's face turned dark.
"You told her about Cassidy?"
"Of course not. She got into my phone. I had been exchanging texts with him about getting something from his safe. Just some bearer bonds, but the text was there. I know she saw it. She is too careful to miss it." "You do know what's locked in that safe, don't you?"
"Of course I do. And that's why you need to stop her. She's your daughter, but she's different now. More dangerous."
Mars nodded, stood, and began walking away without another word. Belyakov stood himself and pursued him.
"You are planning something, something I know nothing about. We've been comrades for 40 years, friends. I've always been there with you, been there for you. Tell me, David, Fjo, what's all this about? What's your endgame?"
General Fyodor Zakharov, a.k.a. David Mars, looked up to the gray sky, and rain washed his face. After a time, he said,
"You don't understand. Nobody understands but me. There is no endgame in the Cold War. It is a permanent conflict of ideas, of soldiers, of spies. I have devoted my life, I have devoted everything I have, everything I am, to the great battle against the insipid forces of the West. They fought back. They took so damn much from me. But I will reap my vengeance soon, Vladdy. I don't want anything to do with your personal war, Fjo. I did not sign up to.
You have connections in Moscow still?"
"Of course I do. Only by the Kremlin's good graces have I been so successful."
"But, Vladimir, you are forgetting the most important thing about Russians living abroad."
Mars stepped close. "As long as your nuts are in Moscow, the Kremlin can squeeze whenever they want." Belyakov felt the menace from his old friend and colleague.
"And you are the Kremlin?"
Zakharov shook his head.
"No. I'm just a man in the middle, passing on helpful advice to an old friend. This operation you've cooked up on your own, I don't believe any of it is sanctioned."
David Mars said,
"The Rodina will benefit, and they will benefit more if they don't know what I'm doing."
Belyakov blew out a worried sigh.
"That's a dangerous game, comrade."
"For dangerous times, comrade."
General Fyodor Zakharov walked off without another word, and this time, Belyakov did not follow. David Mars continued towards the bridge, thinking about resolve now. He was a hair's breadth away from the culmination of his life's work. He could not let anything interrupt it. Not even his little girl. He steeled himself for what he would have to do in the coming days. His men formed around him, and together they walked back over the bridge and climbed into a waiting limousine. Once they were all inside, Mars said,
"Mr. Fox, I need you to take Hines here along with a crew of two, no, make it three good men to the offices of Terry Cassidy. Take the Israelis, they are good. I expect they will encounter an intruder this evening. Is all that clear? All but the rules of engagement when they find the intruder. The intruder will be taken alive. No exceptions." He turned to John Hines and pointed a finger his way. "Alive."
Hines replied,
"Right, sir. Alive. Very well."
Fox hesitated, then added,
"It would help if you could tell us something about our target."
Mars turned to Fox.
"My daughter is not dead. She went to Belyakov, and he led her to Terry Cassidy's office. She'll go there next, looking for answers about me."
Despite his fury and his concern, he smiled a little.
"And if you don't stop her, she'll find the safe, and she'll crack it like it was nothing."
He smiled even more now, and his eyes filled again with tears.
"I taught her well."
Zach Hightower had spent the first couple of hours of the day tailing Maria Palumbo, a CIA officer and one of the four who was a potential source for all the recent agency compromises. To be precise, tailing wasn't the correct term. He was using an old FBI tactic known as bumpering, an overt surveillance measure used to cause a subject to flee or make some other desperate choice that might tip off the surveillance professional that the subject being followed was indeed checking for a tail and had something to hide. Police departments all over the country did the same thing, but referred to the tactic as jamming. It was the opposite of covert surveillance, really. Zach wanted Palumbo to know he was tailing her, watching her, tracking her every movement, and he hoped this would reveal to him that she was indeed the mole. But Palumbo didn't bite. At all, after Zach picked up on the fact that she'd noticed the tail just after dropping her kids off at school, she began a series of idle turns throughout Chantilly, clearly looking to see what Zach in his black Chevy Suburban would do. Zach stayed tight on her ass until she pulled into the parking lot of an Au Bon Pan for breakfast. He parked just out front and watched her eat a muffin and sip coffee while talking on her phone, occasionally stealing glances outside at Zach's car. At 9 a.m., she threw away her trash, put down her phone, and then stood there, hands on her hips, staring at Hightower. He stared back through his Oakleys, unfazed, enjoying exerting sanctioned pressure, even though he had not a clue if this woman had done anything to warrant this stress. He got the feeling something was wrong in the pit of his stomach about 30 seconds before the flashing lights broke his staring contest with Palumbo. He looked in his rear view and saw three blue and white squad cars from the Fairfax County Police Department pulling up. They blocked him in expertly. He figured Palumbo had called CIA security and told them about the tale, and they alerted the local yokels. Zach sighed, pulled out a set of fake credentials from the folio given to him by Suzanne Brewer, and rolled down his window. Palumbo drove off while Zach got a talking to. He had a legend and a story ready. He thought this woman had sideswiped his wife's vehicle outside their kid's high school the day before, and he was just trying to get a look all the way around her car to see if there was evidence. It was good enough for Fairfax County PD, and within 15 minutes he was driving off, heading towards his next target. Palumbo was a bust. There was no way, Zach thought, that anyone could be so cool as to quickly call in an unknown contact to CIA security if they were, in fact, spying for a foreign entity. He'd mentally scratch her name off the list, and then move on to the next in line, Assistant Deputy Director of Support, Marty Wheeler. At lunch, Zach Hightower stood in line at Whole Foods on P Street in central D.C., holding a plastic bottle of some sort of green sludge that he had no plans to consume. The woman in front of him was hot enough for Zach, for a mom anyway, and he was stealing glances at her ass as she leaned over her baby in the shopping cart to hand him a toy. But Hightower was on duty, so he broke his gaze off her backside and returned it to the man in front of her. Marty Wheeler paid for his salad and his can of cold green tea, and he headed over to the dining area in front of the store. Zack watched him intently while the woman checked out, and then Zack bought his green shit and walked over next to Wheeler. The CIA Assistant Deputy Director of Support sat alone at a long table with four chairs on each side, and although there were plenty of other tables around, Zack plopped down across from him at the far end. Wheeler looked up, smiled, and nodded to the fit and intense-looking man in the beard, and then returned to his salad. Zack opened his drink and, despite himself, he took a sip.
"For fuck's sake," he said, then sealed the bottle back up.
Wheeler glanced up at him again and cracked a smile, but soon he was looking at his phone. Zack followed the 51-year-old out to his car after lunch, walking just 50 feet or so behind him, then climbed into his Suburban, parked two down from Wheeler's Mercedes C-Class in the garage. Wheeler pulled out onto P Street and turned left, and Zack stayed on his bumper. This continued until Wheeler pulled into a parking lot a block from the U.S. Capitol. Zack parked nearby, in sight of his car, then followed the man on foot towards the Capitol building. Zack sighed. He got nothing out of Wheeler, not even a recognition he had a tail. This dude was either as pure as the driven snow, completely oblivious, or incredibly well-trained at counter-surveillance. Zack knew he couldn't write him off like he had with Palumbo. He'd need more intel on Wheeler before deeming him clean, but he wasn't going into the Capitol building to get it. Zack headed back to his car. There were two more on the list. Alf Carlson, who he'd been told had already flown to London in advance of the Five Eyes meeting in Scotland in a few days, and Lucas Renfro, the deputy director of support and the highest ranking of the four on the list. Renfro had been at Langley all morning, where Zack couldn't touch him, but he told himself he'd go position himself to follow the DDS when he left work. He'd lean on Renfro for a while to see if he crapped his pants, because his first two tales of the day had been wholly unsatisfactory, particularly for a man who enjoyed scaring people. Chapter 27. A steady rain pelted the canvas painter's tarp lying over Court Gentry's body, creating a soft, relaxing sound that made him want to take a nap. But he kept his eye in sight of his rifle and ignored the moisture from the wet, flat rooftop that soaked his clothes. He was as close to invisible as one could be in cloudy daylight in the center of one of the leading capital cities in the world. On his fifth-floor roof, he was just slightly above the other buildings, all but shielding him from below and through the windows of their lower floors, and the tarp was close enough in color to the roof itself, both were covered with white paint, that someone would have to come up here and walk around for a while with the intention of spotting him to do so. Court fought his desire to nod off and looked through the four-power scope above his suppressed rifle, centering it on a window in the building across the street. This was Terry Cassidy's private office. Court watched the man as he sat at his desk, alternating phone calls with typing on his computer and chatting with assistants. It was only noon, but Court had been in position since before the man arrived for work that morning, and while doing so, he'd been getting a feel for the security of the location. There were guards in the lobby, cameras all around, and the windows looked secure, and there was no adjoining rooftop access. The only way over that Court saw was either to infiltrate with a stolen ID or to somehow get across the street with a cable and access the roof. Alternatively, he could scale the outside, perhaps, and make entry far away from the guards and hardest access points. It wouldn't be easy. As he slowly scanned the two windows of Cassidy's office, his earpiece buzzed. He tapped it to open the call.
"Yup," he said softly.
As expected, as always, in fact, it was Suzanne Brewer.
"You weren't supposed to take the Volvo. London Station is pissed."
"That's what I like about you, Brewer. You've always got your mind centered on the important stuff."
When Brewer said nothing, he sighed.
"I'll return it when I'm done."
Brewer snorted out an angry laugh.
"The last car you misappropriated is probably still on fire up in the East Midlands."
Court smiled at this.
I'll be super careful with this one. Government property and all. Look, I see where your priorities lie, but I'm out here trying not to get a bullet up my ass, so if you could help me out a little instead of busting my balls, I'd appreciate it.
Fine. First, your mission to locate and recover Dirk Visser is over.
Why is that?
He was located and recovered. Out of the Thames, in fact. It looked like he'd been run over by a truck, but Scotland Yard is looking into the exact cause of death.
Court sighed, then moved on.
What do we know about a lawyer in London? I guess they call them solicitors here, named Terry Cassidy.
Court could hear Brewer typing. It would be just 7 a.m. in Washington now, and this woman was sitting at a computer, either at Langley or at home. He doubted she had a life beyond work, and wondered if she and he actually had more in common than he'd imagined. After 30 seconds, Brewer said,
Terence Albert Cassidy, aged 43, born in West Sussex, divorced, father of...
I don't need his Wikipedia page. I need to know who he runs with, who his clients are.
More tapping on the computer.
He deals in offshores, cryptocurrencies, that much we know. No known ties to any criminal element that I see, but I'll keep digging.
Shit, Court said.
Here's something. He travels to Russia regularly.
Moscow?
Yes, always, every month or so.
Court said, I guess I'm going to have to go in and take a look at his office tonight. Keep digging, see if you can find anything relevant about his contacts, clients, known associates in general.
Understood.
She started to speak again, but Court noticed something through his scope and disconnected the call in his ear. He then concentrated fully on Cassidy, who had stood up from his desk and walked over to a painting on the opposite wall of the room. He reached a hand behind the frame, slid it up high, almost out of reach, and then he pulled the painting open like a door. Behind it, Court clearly saw the dial of a safe built into the cherry-paneled wall. The solicitor worked the dial for several seconds, swung the latch, and opened the small door to the safe. Inside, he pushed a button, and a section of wall, from the floor to 6 feet above it, slid open a few inches. Cassidy pushed this up, then stepped into a large vault. Court was no expert safecracker, but with the right audio equipment and enough time, he thought he'd have a fair chance to get into this vault on his own. He put down his weapon with the 4-power scope and hefted his 10-power binos, and through these, he was able to determine the make and approximate model of the door to the vault. He jotted down some notes on a waterproof pad next to him, then continued scanning the office. Cassidy reappeared seconds later, locked the safe, and replaced the painting by closing it on its hinges. He then returned to his desk. Court knew then and there he would need to enter the building tonight, but to do so, he wanted a lot more intel about the property and those in it, so he settled himself in for a long day of watching in the rain. Gorik Sholga pulled up to his office at Gateway Shipping and Air Freight in South London just after lunch, climbed out of his Renault, and entered through the open warehouse door. In front of him were dozens of 40-foot shipping containers and Connex boxes, all either just off ships and out of customs, or else in the process of being loaded with export goods for overseas. He was 36 years old, reasonably good-looking, with a serious brow and dark brown hair, but his suit was off the rack and a little loose-fitting, and he walked with a bounce in his step that made it hard for others to take him too seriously. He greeted a couple of his shift leaders and walked down a long hallway to the administrative section of the forwarding company. He entered his office and dropped his keys on his desk, then took off his raincoat and hung it on a coat rack. He'd just begun to turn around when he heard the hammer clicking back on a pistol. Sholga knew enough about guns to feel sure he'd heard the cylinder of a revolver turn as well, because although Gorik was officially the manager of this freight forwarding concern in London, in truth, he worked for SVR.
"Who's there?"
he asked in English, still staring at his coat on the rack in the corner in front of him. But the reply came in Russian, and it was a woman's voice, one that sounded faintly familiar to him.
"I'm not going to hurt you, Gorik, not unless you really, really want me to."
He raised his hands, cursed himself for not checking the corner of his office as he entered, and said,
"Well, can I take a look at you before I decide? Turn slowly."
Gorik Shulga turned very slowly. He saw a woman seated in the wooden chair across the room, and the pistol pointed at his chest. When he took his eyes off the gun and put them on the face of the brunette woman, his head snapped back in surprise.
Serena, is that you?
Zoya Zakharova's codename with SVR had been Serena Vodoshoy Travogi, which meant Banshee, but it had been shortened operationally to simply Serena.
Da, it's me. How have you been, Gorik?
I heard you were dead.
Not true.
I heard you turned traitor on your nation.
Not true either.
I heard you were booted out of SVR.
That actually is accurate.
You killed an SVR operative in Thailand. Utkin, is that right?
Da.
Well, Serena, I'm not Oleg Utkin. You will find me harder to kill.
If it comes down to it, I doubt that.
Why is that?
Because, Gorik, Utkin had a gun to my head and I still managed to kill him. And now I have a gun pointed at your head. Want to see if you're faster than a speeding bullet?
Oleg wasn't.
Shulga offered no protest. Instead, he sat down in front of the Russian woman with a small pistol pointed at him.
Zoya said, I always liked you. You were one of the good ones, slower witted than many of the others, but sweeter.
He raised an eyebrow.
Thanks, I guess, he said.
I would feel terrible if there were some misunderstanding now and I had to shoot you.
And I might even feel worse.
Zoya smiled, repeated,
I always liked you.
Not enough to let me get that black dress off you that night in Venice, as I recall.
Now Zoya gave a tired little laugh.
You were drunk, and we were in the middle of an operation. Under different circumstances, you might have succeeded.
What do you want?
Stuff.
Stuff? What stuff?
Tools, gear, kit, supplies.
You are out of SVR. Why would I give you anything from the London cache?
I would have thought the answer would be obvious.
She waved the gun back and forth in front of her face. Shulga said,
Oh, right. Killing two SVR officers won't get you into much more hot water than killing just one.
Exactly. Listen, I know you have 3 40-foot sea containers of cached SVR weapons and other gear here on your warehouse floor. You and I are going to walk down there, I'm going to take a few items, and then I'm going to leave. At that point, you have 3 choices. Either you alter some paperwork to make the equipment disappear, or you make it look like you were robbed overnight by some unknown subject, or you tell SVR your security was shit, Serena, the burned dead officer, got the drop on you, and you outfitted her with enough equipment to conduct an intelligence operation.
Gorik's face turned gray.
Yeah,
Zoya said.
You get the picture, don't you?
I don't know what you think you're doing, Serena. You're crazy. You always were off in your own little world, motivated by something other than our nation. Some desire to make your dead father proud. Well, I don't think he'd be so proud of you now.
Zoya did not respond.
So, who are you working for? If I were working for anyone, I wouldn't be here stealing equipment from you, would I? I have a personal interest in a delicate situation, and I need to figure some things out on my own.
With guns and knives and bombs.
She raised an eyebrow.
You've got bombs?
When he didn't answer, she said,
Kidding. I'll need a pistol and ammunition. A couple of fixed-blade knives. But what I really need is surveillance tech, climbing gear, audio equipment for safe cracking, that sort of thing. You can lose that sort of equipment and cover for it.
I can't cover for a lost gun, he said flatly.
Give me one of your local purchases, one you haven't logged with Yasenevo.
He made a face.
What are you talking about?
Come on, Gorik. We came up the ranks together until you topped out at 30. I'm sure you remember I used to run foreign caches at the beginning of my career. I know how the game is played. You have official equipment and you have unofficial equipment. Black market shit in case you need to pass it out to a proxy. Give me one of those guns, the rest of the gear I ask for, and you can paper over this entire day.
Gorik just eyed her for a long time.
What do I get in return?
Zoya rolled her eyes.
Again, dummy, I'm pointing a gun at you. You get to live.
She added,
Doubt you'd ever have figured out how to get my dress off if I let you try back in Venice.
25 minutes later, Zoya Zakharova left Gateway Shipping and Air Freight with a backpack on her back and a second, smaller backpack strapped around her front. Gorik was back in his office, and Zoya put the odds at 50-50 as to whether he was already on the phone to Moscow. She hoped he wouldn't make that call, of course, but to tip the scales in her favor if he did, she decided she would speed up her work even more here in London. She'd go to the office of Terry Cassidy this evening. She'd find that damn safe, and she hoped whatever was inside would help her figure out her next move. Chapter 28. 1 month earlier. David Mars arrived in Edinburgh with Fox, Hines, and a full security crew of 6 men who knew how to dress, act, and move as if they were not a security crew. They wore civilian attire and nothing that screamed tactical tuxedo. Their weapons remained perfectly concealed. HK MP7s with folded stocks under arms or in instantly accessible gym bags over their shoulders, and various makes and models of pistols carried under their shirts in the appendix position. As Fox, Mars, and Hines headed along Lauriston Place, past buildings that made up part of the University of Edinburgh, the UK-born and trained security detail commander walked 10 yards ahead. The principal was flanked by 2 armed protection agents, and 2 more walked 20 feet behind the trio, but not in any set formation. A 6th man was 100 yards ahead, looking for threats, but in a low-profile manner. Mars, Fox, and Hines finally entered the building that housed Janice Wan's research lab, passed through an unmarked door, and took an elevator to the 3rd-floor lab. While 3 of the detail remained outside to keep their eyes open for trouble, the security commander and 1 of his men came with the protectees. The point man was already in the lab, checking over everyone there. Wan was there, in the middle of the laboratory, at a stand-up desk with a laptop computer. Around her, 2 technicians worked on 1 of the fermentation vats, monitoring temperature and moisture via gauges on the side of a cylinder that looked like a large high-tech oil drum.
"Good morning, Doctor," he said as he crossed the room. "How lovely to see you."
Wan did not return the smile, but she did shake his proffered hand. He always felt her do this with reticence, and he remembered reading in her file that the Russians had found her to be psychologically damaged and unable to form intimate relationships or even friendships. Something from her childhood, Mars imagined, but he didn't really care. He said,
"We just wanted to drop in and see how you are getting along with the task of growing the spores from the material taken from Stockholm."
She replied curtly,
"We will speak in my office first."
Mars raised an eyebrow at Fox, but followed her compliantly. 1 minute later, the 2 sat alone in the small and spare office, cups of steaming tea in front of them. Mars didn't love green tea, but his English manners, learned in the last 35 years of his 62 years on Earth, obliged him to sip it. He tried a little small talk, but as usual, Wan was mission-focused in the extreme. She interrupted his comment on the weather to say,
"Regarding the development of the plague spores, it is impossible for me to give you a progress report with completion percentages and time projections, because I do not yet know how much developed Yersinia pestis is needed for our operation."
"Understood. Perhaps just let me know the percentage increase in the bacteria you have grown. I can make a layman's estimation from that," and
Janice Wan interrupted.
"No, I am a scientist, Mr. Mars. I don't want a layman's estimation. I need firm information to do my job. I need more information."
"What are you telling me?"
"I am telling you it is no longer negotiable. You reveal the target to me now, or I leave this project."
Mars was not a man to take ultimatums quietly, even if they were reasonable, as he had to allow that this one was. But he caught himself from lashing out. He saw Wan as a crucial and powerful weapon, but one that needed to be carefully handled to prevent a misfire. Despite some misgivings, he said,
"Doctor, you are quite right. It's time."
He put the tea down on the table and sat back, crossing his legs.
"Do you know what the term 5 eyes refers to?"
The younger woman made a face of frustration.
You do know I have training as an intelligence operative, don't you?
Mars held a hand up. My apologies, Doctor. I did not mean to be patronizing. Well, you are probably also aware that Five Eyes has a conference each year in a different location, but you might not know that this year it will be here in Scotland. First, there will be a series of meetings in London, but only among the principals and their deputies. Then they will join their larger staffs at a 13th-century castle and resort property in the Highlands, just south of Inverness. Juan nodded slowly.
How many people?
There will be over 400 intelligence officers, executives, security personnel, and administrators meeting each day at the property. Many are staying there, but all the hotels and rooms to let in the area are filled as well. Each of the five nations will have a full array of representatives in attendance. Her eyes widened with the recognition of the opportunity before her.
Who, specifically, will be at this location?
As you are probably aware, the U.S. intelligence community contains 16 separate agencies, and key members of all of them will be represented. CIA, NSA, FBI, Homeland Security, Office of Naval Intelligence, and so on and so forth. 170 attendees at the conference will be American. The British have 90 attending. Canada, New Zealand, and Australia have smaller contingents, but it is not the sheer number of people at the castle that is important. Juan knew what he meant by this, because this was Juan's field of expertise.
No, it's the access these people have to their co-workers when they return to their respective countries after the conference.
Precisely, said Mars. Think about almost 200 or so members of the U.S. intel community leaving the conference and returning to Langley, their foreign stations, military bases, wherever. If they are infected with the disease, they would not show symptoms for days, giving them plenty of time to intermingle unknowingly with their colleagues. They will be hosts for this quickly spreading weapon. When she spoke again, Mars was fascinated by her nimble mind's instant transformation into utter mission focus.
We don't need to worry about the bacteria. We will have more than double what we need for this task. I have this under control. We must talk about the proper means of delivery and distribution of the bacteria. This castle will have some sort of natural ventilation we can use. Aerosol delivery would be best and most efficient, but we'll have to find a way to ensure that no one detects anything amiss when the attack happens. We have to infect the population without them realizing it.
Mars was pleased that he had revealed more information to Juan, because now he could concentrate on the op fully. He said, "Too true. We can't shell the building with mortars filled with plague, because they would realize they had been attacked, and doctors would simply give all the attendees antibiotics."
"Exactly," she said. "The virus needs to incubate in the body for only 8 hours, and then it is terminal. Only heavy antibiotics. Cephalexin, for example, administered within that short window can save the infected patient."
Juan added,
"We can use a crop duster. It is an effective means of delivery, assuming they use them in Scotland."
"They are all over the Scottish Highlands," Mars said, "used to keep back the heather and bracken that grows insidiously there."
"I will have to check the weather conditions, and you'll need to find a good pilot. Precision will be required."
"I am already working on that. Now, the location of the Five Eyes conference is Castle Enric on Loch Ness. The location is rented out for conferences, but the rest of the time it is a five-star hotel. My agents and I have stayed there at different times over the past 2 months, looking for vulnerabilities. If you like, you and I can stay the night as well."
Juan immediately snapped back. "In separate rooms, I assume?"
Mars flashed a glance to Fox. "Certainly, Doctor." Fox smiled, his way of showing Mars that this woman was nuts. Mars said, "Don't worry, Dr. Juan. This entire enterprise is not just a means for me to get to know you better." She did not react to this.
"How soon can this be arranged?"
"How does the weekend sound?"
"Excellent," Juan said.
And for the first time in the conversation, she smiled. Present day. The London rain stopped long before the sun went down, and by 11 p.m. the summer air was cool and misty. Court found himself on a different roof closer to Terry Cassidy's office now, right next door to the one he'd spent 6 hours on earlier in the day. He'd chosen this building because it was directly across from ductwork that ran up the length of his target location, and although the aluminum piping looked wet and not exactly sturdy, he thought he could use it to his advantage. He had a climbing harness and gloves with him and had decided his best bet was to go down and cross the street out of sight of the guards in the lobby, and then make his way up the wall and move all the way up to either the rooftop to access the door there or, better still, find some breachable window along the way. He was taking his time, though. There was always more tactical intelligence to pull off a target before acting, and many an operation had failed because someone had decided they knew enough to push ahead when they were, in fact, missing one critical piece of information that spelled the difference between life and death. He had his suppressed and subsonic short-barreled rifle up here with him, but it was zipped in its case. He had no plans to shoot anybody tonight, but he'd wanted the weapon on hand in case organized criminal elements who were clearly working with Cassidy were present and this whole thing went south. He'd climb carrying only his Glock, which wasn't much firepower, but slinging the .300 Blackout SBR up the side of a building on his back, using the thin aluminum and wet masonry as foot and handholds, would be no fun at all. He'd left the Glock 43 back at the apartment, not wanting to be encumbered by anything strapped to his ankle while he climbed. He took a break to eat a bag of raisins he'd brought with him, and to drink his last bottle of water. He bit into a protein bar, chewed for a moment, then shoved the rest into his mouth. He picked up his binos one last time before descending and gave one final slow scan to the building across the street when his night vision image stopped and froze on the northeast corner of the structure. There he saw a figure dressed in black, stepping over the third floor balcony and then crouching down by the door latch there. Where the hell did he come from? It seemed to be some sort of a burglar, or someone with the exact same plans he had, to snoop on one of the offices inside. This was opposite to the end of the building from where Cassidy's office was, but there was no way he could penetrate the building now that there was some other jackass in there, potentially tripping off alarms or otherwise drawing attention to the place. No, he'd have to sit tight and watch. "Asshole," he muttered as the figure opened the latch and disappeared inside the building. Zoya Zakharova had performed a grand total of 12 minutes reconnaissance on the building before walking across a darkened portion of the street away from the lights of the front lobby, leaping up onto a thin iron pipe along the wall, and then pulling herself to a first-floor windowsill. From there, she free-climbed up to the second story, which in Europe meant she was now 3 floors above the ground. It had taken her all of 40 seconds, and after vaulting a balcony railing and dropping behind it, then picking a simple latch lock and slipping into what appeared to be an office break room, she squatted in the corner and listened for noises. There was a patrol of 2 guards. She heard them talking as they passed, and then a stairwell door opened, and she heard 2 pairs of feet descending. She stood and went for the door, then began skulking up the hall. She had 2 stories to climb, and to do it, she moved towards the stairwell on the opposite side of the building from the one the guards used.
"Where are you, you stupid son of a bitch?"
Court muttered to himself on the roof across the street. He continued to scan with his binos, looking through every window he could see, desperately trying to get some sort of a fix on the intruder. While doing this, he tapped his earpiece, placing a call to the one number in his phone. 20 seconds later, he got an answer.
"Brewer."
"No chance you have someone else doing a sneak and peek on Cassidy's building, is there?"
"No chance whatsoever. I assumed you could handle that by yourself. Was I overly optimistic?"
"Well, I could have, if some random dipshit didn't just scale up the side of the building and climb in through a balcony door."
"You're kidding. What if he's going for the safe?"
"Then I guess I'll smash him over the head when he gets out of there, and I'll take whatever he took out of the safe. My concern, though, is that he fails and this makes it impossible for me to get in there until their security relaxes again."
"Right," Suzanne Brewer said. "What do you need?"
"Wait one," Court said,
because he scanned Cassidy's office and saw the masked figure moving through the darkness there, staying away from the window but not out of view from someone with night vision equipment. The figure looked over the room, began opening drawers in wooden file cabinets and thumbing through them, and then opened up a computer there on the desk. Shit. Subject is in Cassidy's office, definitely hunting for something.
A safe?
He's rifling through the desk.
Keep watching and reporting what you see.
The figure moved to a paneled wall behind the desk and began feeling around. He was 30 feet away from the painting the safe was hidden behind, and Court doubted there was any chance he'd find it. The person in the office then went back to the file cabinet and fidgeted with his mask for a moment, lining up the eye holes to read some papers in the file. After several seconds of this, the figure reached up and pulled the knit mask off his head. Shoulder-length brunette hair tumbled out of the balaclava. Court blinked in surprise. The figure was facing away from him, kneeling in front of the bottom drawer in the file cabinet, but Court put the subject's height around 5'8", and he noticed the lean frame did seem to have some feminine curves. Was he looking at a woman? Court said,
"Brewer."
"I'm here."
Here's a twist. The target is a..."
Just then, the person squatting turned towards the door to the office. Through Court's night vision binos and their 10-power magnification, he could easily see the face of Zoya Zakharova and the look of alarm on it. Court felt a muscle spasm in his low back and the burn of fresh adrenaline and dopamine in his system. He'd thought about this face in front of him nearly constantly for the past 4 months, told himself he'd probably never lay eyes on it again, and now the face was here, right in front of him, and expressing imminent danger. Brewer spoke.
"I lost transmission. Do you have me, Violator?"
Court didn't answer. He just bit his lip while he watched the former Russian operative close the file cabinet, spin around, then crawl behind the desk.
"Violator, how do you copy?"
After a long pause, Court said,
The subject in Cassidy's office is identified."
"Identified? Identified as who?"
It's Zoya."
Clearly, Brewer could not process what she was hearing.
"What did you say?"
"Zoya."
"Zakharova is... she's there? In the UK?"
"In the lawyer's office, right now, hiding. Looks like she thinks she hears someone coming."
Brewer said,
"What the hell does any of this have to do with her?"
"Lady, don't ask me. I haven't got a fucking clue what's going on with any of this shit. Just tell me what you want me to do."
Chapter 29 Suzanne Brewer sat at her desk on the 6th floor of CIA's Langley headquarters, her phone to her ear. Her eyes were closed while she tried to process the new and utterly dissonant information her agent had just passed on to her. Anthem was in play in London. But for whom? And how did she get there? Her first inclination was to tell Violator to shoot Zoya Zakharova in the head from standoff distance right this moment. But she was no fool. She knew there was no way he would comply with the order. Instead, she said,
"Just watch her."